This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the United States, called on Israel Thursday to hold new elections, saying he believes Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way in the country's bombardment of Gaza.
The Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then. And the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in the chamber, rebuked Schumer for his suggestion that Israel hold new elections.
It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel.
After Schumer's Senate speech, White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby said there would be no immediate change in U.S. policy toward the conflict, which has included sending arms to Israel. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has appointed his longtime economic advisor to be the new next prime minister in the face of U.S. pressure to reform the Palestinian Authority as part of Washington's post-war vision for Gaza. Mohamed Mustafa, a U.S.-educated economist and political independent, will head a technocratic government in the Israeli-occupied West Bank that could potentially administer Gaza ahead of eventual statehood. But those plans face major obstacles, including strong opposition from Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israel-Hamas war that is grinding on with no end in sight. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Voting in Russia's presidential election got underway early on Friday. We get the details from VOA's Alexis Strope.
Voters are heading to the polls in Russia for a three-day presidential election that is all but certain to extend President Vladimir Putin's rule by six more years after he stifled dissent. The election takes place against the backdrop of a ruthless crackdown that has crippled independent media and prominent rights groups and given Putin full control of the political system. It also comes as Moscow's war in Ukraine enters its third year. Voters will be casting their ballots through Sunday at polling stations across the vast country's 11 time zones, as well as in illegally annexed regions of Ukraine. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
As fires broke out and violence continued in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince, a powerful gang leader threatened political leaders who are set to take part in a planned transitional council and govern the Caribbean nation. Under pressure from the United States, Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced Monday that he would step down once the transitional council was in place. The White House confirmed Thursday that Henry is in Puerto Rico. The calm following Henry's announcement eventually gave way to a resurgence in violence, including an attack on a police academy Thursday. Haitian authorities have expanded a nighttime curfew until Sunday. An appeals court has denied Trump White House official Pete Navarro's bid to stave off his jail sentence on contempt of Congress charges. We get the details from the AP's Jackie Quinn.
A federal appeals court in Washington says Peter Navarro cannot remain free. While he challenges his conviction on charges, he refused to cooperate with a congressional investigation into the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Navarro was found guilty of defying a subpoena for documents and a deposition and has been ordered to report to prison by March 19th. He's the second Trump aide sentenced to prison. Advisor Steve Bannon, who went before a different judge, was allowed to remain free pending his appeal. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The Mali extremist group Al-Shabaab says its fighters attacked a hotel in the capital Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab said on its Telegram channel that its fighters managed to penetrate the SYL Hotel, which is located not far from the presidential palace in a normally secure part of Mogadishu. The hotel is patronized by government officials. There was no immediate word on casualties. Attacks in the seaside capital had reduced in recent weeks amid a beefing up of security there. Al-Shabaab, which opposes Somalia's federal government, is responsible for many lethal attacks on hotels and other places over the years. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Today's Friday, March 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa law enforcement agencies investigate over 300,000 fraudulent visas and residence permits.
Therefore, the government of Zimbabwe would like to dismiss any suggestions that this is a new development between Harare and Washington. As President Edim Nangagwa and other Zimbabweans in the 2024 revised executive order have always been under sanctions.
Zimbabwe government responds to modified U.S. sanctions announced by the Biden administration this week.
The world is at a crucial crossroads for gender equality. We are in a world where we have increasing conflicts, we see the changing climate, we see a lot more polarization in society, and standing up for women's rights is more important than ever.
And women's advocates say unpaid work, particularly those in developing economies like Africa, are a barrier to gender equity. Those stories, plus Samson Omale's sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe's government has responded to modified U.S. sanctions announced by the Biden administration this week, which renew measures on President Emmerson Mnangagwa and some senior leaders, while removing others from the list. U.S. embassy officials say the new sanctions aim to improve Zimbabwe's human rights record and reduce corruption. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe Information Minister Jennifer Muswere on Wednesday condemned the U.S. government for imposing fresh sanctions on President Emmerson Mnangagwa and other senior leaders, along with some companies. Muswere called for an immediate and unconditional removal of what he called illegal sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe's leader.
Therefore, the government of Zimbabwe would like to dismiss any suggestions that this is a new development between Harare and Washington. As President Edim Nangagwa and other Zimbabweans in the 2024 revised executive order have always been under sanctions. To this end, the government of Zimbabwe condemns the perpetuation of the heinous sanctions against Zimbabwe and their intended effects to decimate our economy. Consequently, we do not celebrate the current delisting of other players in our political economy from the sanctions list. This is on the basis that Zimbabwe was never supposed to be under any form of sanctions from another nation in the first place.
U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires Lawrence Socha on Wednesday said the Biden administration was committed to ensuring the sanctions are relevant, timely, and targeting those closely connected to corruption and serious human rights abuses, including President Mnangagwa.
In Zimbabwe, we continue to witness gross abuses of political, economic, and human rights. The targeting of civil society and severe restrictions on political activity have stifled fundamental freedoms, while key actors, including government leaders, have siphoned off government resources for personal gains. U.S. sanctions are not on the country of Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe's government blames sanctions for the country's economic struggles since the early 2000s. Critics attribute the decline to corruption and bad policies by Harare. Marvelous Kumalo is the spokesman of the rights group Crisis Coalition of Zimbabwe.
We have never invited sanctions or celebrated their existence. We are happy now because the Harare administration has always blamed sanctions whenever they failed to deliver in terms of socio-economic goods. So now we'll keep them in check and see whether they will deliver because the sanctions have been reviewed. But on the other hand, we also urge our Zimbabwe government to revise their human rights record, their public corruption, issues to do with the reforms. We'll be happier if they institute reforms that will make Zimbabwe a better country.
Obed Masaraure, president of Amalgamated Raw Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, hopes the new measures announced by Washington will do more than improve the economic picture.
Zimbabwe keeps on sliding back with regards to respect of human rights, democracy, what incredible elections. We have also seen massive looting of our mineral wealth. All this has led to serious poverty among people. Teachers are also affected. Teachers are earning way below the poverty line. That is at least why at least 4,000 are leaving the country annually to seek universities. So we hope that this sanctuary regime can apply pressure on Harare so that it reforms and creates a governance architecture that really accommodates the hopes and aspirations of our people, and that is democracy.
In announcing changes to the new sanctions regime, U.S. President Joe Biden also terminated the official U.S. state of emergency regarding actions and policies of the Zimbabwe government first imposed in 2003 following reports of election rigging and human rights abuses. Columbus Mavungam, VOA News, Harare.
Women's advocates say unpaid work, particularly those in developing economies like Africa, are a barrier to gender equity. They say holistic reforms are needed to tackle the issue as the world marks International Women's Day on Friday. VOA's Ignatius Ano reports from Washington.
On this year's International Women's Day, the United Nations Entity for Gender Equality and the Empowerment of Women, also known as UN Women, says it is using the day to draw the world's attention to the unpaid care work of women around the world. Meja Ben Alarakia is UN Women's Regional Advisor on Women's Economic Empowerment for East and Southern Africa. She tells VOA that in order for the theme of this year's celebration, quote, invest in women, accelerate progress, to translate into the everyday lives of women, it is imperative to address the imbalances.
In Africa, women spend 3 to 4 times more time on unpaid care and domestic work compared to their male counterparts. This means that over the course of a day, if she was to work full time, spend 8 hours at work, spend another 4 hours at home doing unpaid care and domestic work, and then doing other things. So overall, what happens is that women have less time available for taking on other activities, whether it's productive economic activities, whether it's leadership activities, whether it's social activities, leisure activities, taking a nap, or education, because they are using that time to provide these services.
Alarakia also says the number of women and girls affected by violence has soared in conflict-ridden areas around the world, including insecurity in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Sudan, as well as the war in Gaza, Ukraine, and Afghanistan.
The world is at a crucial crossroads for gender equality. We are in a world where we have increasing conflicts. We see the changing climate. We see a lot more polarization in society. And standing up for women's rights is more important than ever.
Shupikai Gwabuya is the focal person on women, human rights defenders at Civicus, a global civil society alliance with offices in Zimbabwe. She tells VOA from Harare that more and more women are participating in civic spaces on the continent, which has drawn the world's attention to some of Africa's crises, like the war in Sudan.
I have been working with women in the diaspora that focus on Sudan, the Sudan conflict in particular. They have held several webinars just to discuss, one, to make people aware of the situation on the ground, and two, to mobilize more support and humanitarian support from Sudan citizens who are in the diaspora. So these are women like doctors, human rights experts, economists, who have come together to give solidarity, but around advocacy of the Sudan situation.
In Africa, a recent report by UN Women indicates over 342 million women and girls are likely to be living in extreme poverty by 2030. If current trends, including geopolitical conflicts, soaring poverty levels, and climate change continue, Gwabuya says investments in women's leadership will help improve their political and economic participation, which could head off that prediction.
Also, advocacy for policy reforms that truly encapsulates women's issues without assumption, but really being evidence-based. Those are some of the interventions that I feel are very important.
With that in mind, both Gwabuya and Alarakia say investments in political, economic, and financial literacy for women everywhere will help bridge the vast gender pay gap.
Thank you so much.
Ignatius Anno, VOA News, Washington.
Top arm officials from the Southern African Regional Bloc, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, visited the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo last week, where they held a high-level meeting in the city of Goma, the capital of embattled North Kivu province. Some residents of Goma, however, were not so sure that the visit would make a difference in terms of the ongoing fighting. And indeed, on Wednesday, the M23 rebel group took over the town of Nyanzale, killing at least 15 people in bomb attacks. This and part of the DRC has been plagued by violence from local and foreign armed groups for nearly 30 years. I asked political analyst David Monda whether he thought SADC forces would be able to pacify eastern DRC, where other international and regional forces have failed.
I think it's highly unlikely, firstly because over 18,000 MONUSCO forces, the US, UN forces were there. They failed to pacify the region. The East African standby force was deployed. It was eventually withdrawn. And I say that for two reasons. SADC, even though they've had previous experience in the area from their deployment there in 2013, the DRC is a huge country. It's a country the size of Western Europe. So even 3,000 troops from SADC is a real small number to police such a huge territory, particularly in the Eastern DRC with the environment, the jungle, you know, the difficult terrain that's there. But I think secondly is the question of the mandate of the SADC forces. This has been a continuing problem with the intervention forces, whether it was the East African Standby Force, whether it was the UN MONUSCO force, and now even SADC. Firstly, what is their mandate? Are they there as peacekeepers? Do they have offensive capabilities? And when, if they are to take offensive capabilities and go after the rebels, to what extent can they do that without actually inserting themselves into a very complicated civil war in the Eastern DRC? I think the second big question is the funding of SADC. South Africa and the members of SADC cannot fund this intervention from SADC in the long term. They might do it in the short term, but eventually they will have to get support from the UN or from some of these major players or the major powers around the world. And there's a big question about whether there'll be a commitment from the major powers to actually fund this, you know, the SADC force, or whether even the UN would be interested in funding the SADC force. Plus, we cannot also count out this question about public opinion in South Africa around these SADC forces. You know, how will South Africans feel when more and more of their troops start dying in the DRC? Remember, it's an election year this year in South Africa, and I think this question will be high on the table in terms of foreign policy, particularly given that South Africa itself is really going through a very difficult economic situation now. Many citizens in South Africa will be questioning, why are we spending so much on troops in DRC when we have all these economic problems at home? So it's really a very multifaceted picture in terms of thinking whether SADC will succeed or not. But I'm skeptical about the chances of SADC succeeding where so many others have failed, particularly even with the UN with a much bigger force than what SADC has right now.
That was political analyst David Monda speaking with us from New York. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impugo in Washington. Today's Friday, March 8th. Still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. In South Africa, law enforcement agencies are investigating 300,000 cases of fraudulent visas and resident permits being issued. As many as 45,000 of them were issued to Chinese nationals. News of the investigation has caused a public outcry in a country with the highest official unemployment rate in the world. Darren Taylor reports.
A report from several South African government agencies says a network of corrupt immigration officials illegally issued thousands of Chinese citizens' visas, residence permits, and even South African identity documents. This opened the door for the Chinese citizens to work in a variety of companies trading with China, and for the allegedly illegal migrants to themselves establish businesses. Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi tells VOA the first offences began at least 7 years ago, and the investigation is going to be long and complicated.
It needs forensic analytics, it needs lawyers, it needs all sorts of people, forensic investigators, and even senior counsels. Some people might need to be arrested, others might be deported, some who have been sitting comfortably with South African documents and citizenship, they might have to be deprived of those documents because they were quite fraudulent.
Motsoaledi says it's pretty obvious why thousands of Chinese citizens chose South Africa as a base.
Some of them find it easier to establish businesses here for whatever reason. But we know, and unfortunately, their ambassador did not like this when I said it before. They also love establishing businesses where they exploit illegal labor. They are not the only ones. You are talking of only Chinese. I think that report has unveiled many other nationalities from all over the world. That I mean, this is only that with the Chinese, they found that very large number, maybe because their population is very big. But I can only conclude that they are looking for business opportunities, which might not flourish back home in China, but will flourish here in South Africa.
Some immigration experts say some Chinese business people have for years hired South African workers illegally because their businesses lack proper registration. They also fail to register the workers as required by labor laws. That allows the Chinese employers to pay extremely low wages and not to provide the workers with basic benefits such as sick leave. The Chinese embassy in Pretoria did not respond to requests for comment. But South Africa's Chinese Business Association said it's actively encouraging all Chinese business people to comply with the law. The association also pointed out the charity work it does, including supplying food parcels to the poor and generators for aged people struggling with the country's power outages. Investigators provided VOA with footage showing the Chinese owner of a textile factory in Johannesburg who couldn't provide documents to prove his business was legitimate. In the video, when the investigator questioned him about his labor practices, the man refused to answer. The investigators say workers showed them a demolished building in which they were living. The laborers had built cave-like structures out of bricks for shelter. In the video, the owner did not answer when the investigator asked why there wasn't adequate shelter, then walked into his own home. Motsoaledi says he's already taken action against immigration officials who sold false documents to Chinese nationals, and more severe punishment would follow after an investigation by South Africa's Hawks Specialized Police Agency.
27 charge sheets have already been finalized. 5 disciplinary hearings have commenced. 12 disciplinary matters have been concluded. 9 officials have been dismissed. Others have been handed over to the Hawks. They are still investigating. 2 officials have actually resigned. 1 official dismissal is subject to an appeal.
South Africa's International Relations Department also declined to comment on whether the affair would cause diplomatic tensions with Beijing. The Chinese Communist Party historically has had close ties with South Africa's governing African National Congress. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Senegalese presidential candidates faced a shortened race to election day on Thursday after the Constitutional Council confirmed the delayed vote would be held on March 24th, kick-starting a competition that remains wide open. Reuters reports uncertainty over the date of the vote has gripped the West African country since early February, when the authorities thwarted bid to postpone the February 25th poll by 10 months, provoked widespread protests and warnings of democratic backsliding. Many hope the worst of the crisis is over after the council ruled on Wednesday that the vote must be held before President Macky Sall's mandate expires on April 2nd, prompting him to schedule it for March 24th, a date the top court has now approved. The new date leaves the 19 candidates little more than 2 weeks to canvass support. It also means for the first time, campaigning will take place during the holy month of Ramadan, when many in the Muslim-majority country fast. It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, Douglas. We begin the sport in Ghana, where the 13th edition of the All Africa Games, Africa's version of the Olympics, will get underway on Friday. The four-year multi-sport event runs from the 8th to the 23rd of March, organized by the African Union, the Association of National Olympic Committees of Africa, the Association of African Sports Confederations, and the Supreme Council for Sports in Africa. The 13th African Games is expected to attract over 13,000 participants, including officials, athletes, media, and volunteers from 54 African countries. Ghana's Minister of Youth and Sports, Mustafa Usib, told journalists ahead of the Games that Ghana is ready to deliver one of the most organized events in the Games' history.
We are going to accommodate our athletes. We are expecting 13,000 participants. Most of the athletes will be housed at the Games Village.
And now to tennis, where tennis world number 6, Hans Jabeur of Tunisia, will take on world number 131, U.S. Katie Vonnegut, on Friday as part of the Indian Wells Open. The Tunisian has made a slow start to the season so far, chalking up 2 wins from 5 matches and a quarterfinal appearance at the Abu Dhabi Open. She also reached the second round of the Australian Open 2024. Friday's game will mark Jabeur's return after withdrawing from the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championships last February due to a knee injury. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has suspended the accreditation of South Africa's Bloemfontein Anti-Doping Laboratory, the only accredited laboratory in Africa, for multiple non-conformities with international standards. In a statement, WADA said it had suspended the accreditation of the South African Anti-Doping Laboratory in Bloemfontein for 6 months. The Bloemfontein Laboratory had already been placed under some restrictions in September last year, while other anti-doping activities were allowed to continue. And now to basketball. The Basketball Africa League, BAL, is set to kick off its expanded fourth season in South Africa. The 2024 BAL season will tip off on Saturday, 9th of March 2024 at the Sunbet Arena in Pretoria, marking the first time BAL games will be played in the country. The 2024 BAL season will feature the top 12 club teams from 12 African countries playing a record 48 matches. Cape Town Tigers small forward Samakelo Sile is fired up for the first BAL game this weekend on home soil.
It's going to be great, you know what I mean, because we're going to have a different sense of motivation having to play and having to just play a high level of basketball here at home, you know what I mean. And so, it was good playing in Egypt, but like playing here at home, it's no other. I feel great. I feel excited. I'm ready for sure.
The official draw of the CAF Futsal African Morocco 2024 tournament was officially conducted on Thursday at the Mohammed VI complex in Rabat, where 8 nations were drawn into 2 groups of 4 each to contest the 7th edition of the competition. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Douglas, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Friday, March 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for joining us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Douglas Simpuga in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.